IGN. It's been nearly 2 years since the tiny helicopter Ingenuity and the one-ton rover Perseverance left planet Earth. In February last year, they landed in a hazardous and previously unexplored part of Mars called the Jezero Crater, where Perseverance is looking for signs of ancient life. Since it's carrying the first working audio microphones on the red planet, we'll leave you with what it sounds like.
I don't know who's getting that or not. 720 WGN. Rod Pyle from Ad Astra. We're going to outer space. I'm John Landecker. Hey, Rod, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Did you get my little joke here? Does anybody get it? Huh?
I missed it.
Well,
I had
the rover
going. There's no humor more fun than the humor you have to explain, right?
Well, yeah. But if you haven't seen Stranger Things, the show on Netflix. Oh, okay. Well, I had a clip from 60 Minutes with Anderson Cooper talking about the rover.
Yeah.
And so he says, listen to this. I got to explain the darn joke. So he says, and it had microphones, and this is what it sounded like. And so then I played the theme from Stranger Things. That's all. Just a little,
Now, if you played the theme from The X-Files or Fringe, I would have recognized it. But I've been meaning to get the Stranger Things, but I haven't yet. So my apologies.
Well, needless to say, Stranger Things is full of strange things.
Yeah.
So Rod Pyle is executive editor of Ad Astra magazine. We talked to him about space developments when that's something in the news. And Rod's going to be here for this hour, and we're going to have another guest join Rod after the 7:30 news, because there's something going on in Canada that has to do with Mars. But we'll get to that later. I understand that a new era of seeing deeper into the universe than ever... Wait a minute. I got to say it. I understand that a new era of seeing deeper into the universe than ever before has begun today. Would you care to illuminate?
You must have watched the press release. So this was a really interesting thing. So for weeks, we've been having the big buildup by NASA. Okay, on July 8th, we're going to announce some of the targets we're going to be looking at first when the web goes hot, which it already has. But, I mean, when they start showing us the images they've managed to download and create.
This would be the James Webb Space Telescope.
James Webb Space Telescope, yeah.
Yes.
The one that just launched 6 months ago and
right.
is finally deployed and out at the Lagrange 2 point and all that. So, and then the big reveal was going to be July 12th, right? NASA's going to show us the first historic images, deepest oldest things ever seen in the universe, all this stuff. All right. And then yesterday, late afternoon, we suddenly get this ping from NASA saying, Joe Biden's going to show the first picture tomorrow. Now, there's got to be a story there, and I suspect it's probably, hey, I'm president, you know, this thing launched and went active on my watch, and I want my Apollo moment, damn it. But that's just conjecture.
Yes.
But anyway... They held a press conference this afternoon, so Kamala Harris, who's the head of the National Space Council, which is part of a NASA oversight organization, came on and gave her introductory remarks, and then Biden came on and did his remarks, and then Bill Nelson, who's the administrator of NASA, came on and actually introduced us to the single image, which is, if you haven't seen it, pretty amazing.
Yep. I got it right in front of me.
It just looks like a bunch of stars, right?
Yes.
But there are no stars visible in that image. Those are all galaxies. So every one of those little points.
Whoa, no kidding.
And this is like a tiny, as they put it, this field of view is the equivalent of a grain of sand held at arm's length.
Oh, my
gosh.
So
this is tiny. Yeah. Shot of the universe. And that's specs, how much stuff is out there.
These specks are all galaxies?
Yeah. And
whoa, man.
You see the little, so there's like some bright ones kind of clustered towards the center.
Yeah.
And that's an object called SMACS0723.
Well, I remember
him. About 4 point, yeah, good friend. It's about 4.6 billion light years away, so that's how far back in time you're looking, effectively, which is, by coincidence, almost exactly the age of, of our solar system. But the stuff behind it, see the little things that look like worms?
Yes, I do.
Those are other galaxies that would not be visible in that image, except that that thing at the center, SMAX 0723, is so massive that it's actually bending the light coming from those little wormy objects, magnifying them, so those, at least according to Bill Nelson, those are more in the 13 billion year old plus range.
Now, as well,
so,
as one,
you know, just get your head wrapped around this. So it's just one massive thing acting like a telescope so that we could see these other massive things that are, we're looking at, you know, just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang. I mean, it makes my teeth hurt just to think about,
you know,
this.
I'm wondering if one of those specks might be Voyager trapped in the Delta Quadrant. Do you think? Do you think? We'll do more with Rod Fylin.
You know,
back.
Captain, what's her name?
Janeway on 720.
Janeway, thank you.
WGN. 720 WGN, I'm John Landecker. That is the actual sound of the rover on Mars. Thought I'd throw it in there. 18 minutes after 7, here at 720 WGN. Listen to these quotes. Today represents an exciting new chapter in the exploration of our universe. Whoa. And it's true. Rod Pyle from Ad Astra Magazine is with us. We're talking at this point in the hour about the picture that's come back from the James Webb Space Telescope's ultra-deep view of the universe, which is really, when you started to, if people can get a hold of this picture today that we're talking about, and you take a look at these little specks, and then you realize that Rod says that each one of them is a galaxy, that is a mind-boggler. You know what I mean? How big is a galaxy, by the way? And I don't mean the one by Ford. How big is the galaxy?
Many light years across. I mean, they're huge.
Wow.
So they're looking at, let's see, there was one. They're looking at a ring, at the Southern Ring Nebula. So these are targets that they're going to be showing images from tomorrow. An object called the Southern Ring Nebula, which is a nebula, so it's not a galaxy, but it's a large gas cloud. But that in itself is a half a light year in diameter.
Jeez.
So that's about 3 trillion miles across, and our galaxy, or excuse me, our solar system, depending on how you measure it, is about 5 to 0.6 billion miles across. So, space is really big. There's a lot of big stuff out there.
I believe
and
that's
some
why
of
they
the
call
other
it.
Things.
Yeah.
Huh?
No, I said I believe that's why they call it space.
Yeah,
because
that's
a lot
very
of
good
it.
Observations.
Yes,
because you watch Stranger Things and you have that kind of mind. And additionally, tomorrow they're going to be showing us the Carina Nebula, which is one of the brightest nebulas. It's about 7,600 light years away, and you might remember that from the Hubble image called the Pillars of Destruction. These weird kind of blue-yellow gas cloud fingers that they showed, and this will be a different view of it because. Since the Webb Space Telescope works in infrared, it can see through a lot of the dust that makes those clouds up. They're going to show us the spectra of a planet called WASP 96b. This is an exoplanet. It's a very hot, large exoplanet. They call it a hot Saturn because of its mass, but size-wise, it's actually bigger than Jupiter. And what makes this kind of unique, among other things, it was the first exoplanet that they've observed that appears to not have clouds in its atmosphere. There's a whole story about, you know, they observe sodium in the spectrum, and that means there isn't water vapor in the atmosphere, so there aren't clouds, and blah, blah, blah. What else makes it interesting is that it's really hot at 1,900 degrees Fahrenheit, and it orbits its star in 3.5 days. So that's how long a year is on that planet. So
a year is 3.5 days?
Yeah. So we'd be
really,
we would have had many birthdays there by now, John. And we'd be
even more ancient than we are. I'd have run out of candles years ago. My God. That's insane.
Well, and they'd all be vaporized because stainless steel and chrome melt on this place, you know? I mean, it's just incredible. And finally, you're going to love this because you're a boomer like me.
Yeah.
They're going to image, or did image, a cluster of galaxies called Stephen's Quartet, which were the, if you remember the movie It's a Wonderful Life, when Clancy, is it Clancy the Angel, is that his name?
I think. Clarence. Yes.
When Clarence gets his assignment, you see those five little blobs of light that are chit-chatting with each other?
Yes.
Out in space. That's Stephen's Quartet. So they had imaged it long ago. It was discovered in the 1800s. Now they're taking new imagery of it. And it's, you know, one of the more remarkable clustering of galaxies together. So, yeah, tomorrow's going to be a big day. And, you know, it's easy to sort of fall into hyperbole when you're talking about this thing, because it's the biggest mirror at 21 feet and the most powerful and the furthest telescope from Earth and all that stuff. But when you look at what it took over the course of this, really, the idea for this started before the George H.W. Bush administration really began to pick up speed under that administration and Clinton, and has been kind of trudging along ever since. What it took to build this massive instrument. Remember, you know, you've got this huge thing that has to unfold 19 different ways with 400 plus moving parts. You can't test it in weightlessness, right? Because it's being built on Earth. So you're doing a lot of guessing. And there have been issues with spacecraft as far back as the 1960s where they were tested in Earth gravity, and either something was forgotten or something was overlooked or something unexpected happened, and you get it out into space and suddenly it doesn't work. And as some of the smart JPL people like to say, all instrumentation is doomed to succeed on tests on Earth. So, you know, the fact that it got out there and did this and that we're actually getting good stuff back from it, which was not the case with Hubble for a while.
Right.
Just incredible. So I got to give it to the NASA guys. If they want to wax a little rhapsodic, I'm right there with them.
At 720 WGN, I'm John Landecker. At 724, we're talking to Rod Pyle from Ad Astra Magazine. A big day in the history of space with a telescope that has reached farther into the universe, the James Webb Space Telescope. The ultra-deep view of the universe is what we're talking about. In the past, when we've been on the air together, you know, we've talked about how, you know, I like science fiction, you like science fiction, you also did some writing on Deep Space Nine and all of that. So, you know this show, For All Mankind? Are you aware of that one?
Yes, sir. Oh, yes, sir.
So, I'm reading this article about this telescope, and it says, including unfurling the massive kite-shaped sun shield. And I think in the last episode of For All Mankind, when they're racing to the moon, somebody unveils a kite shield like that. Am I right? I think so.
I mean, I'm actually a couple of episodes behind on it, so I haven't seen that. Because I was watching The Boys. I had to keep up with that first. But what is important to note about the web is those shields, as they call them, are five layers of really thin mylar that had to, one at a time, unroll and then snap tight and then snap away from the one that it was next to before it was unfurled. So there's like six different actions that had to happen. And for that stuff to not tear and not stretch out of shape and not get hung up with the little cables and pulleys and everything, just amazing. You know, I used to build a lot of goofy little inventions when I was a kid. Yeah. And not only did most of them not work, but they certainly never worked the same way twice. So just from that perspective, looking at what these engineers accomplished, I'm sorry I keep going on and on about this, but I can almost barely believe that it worked, frankly.
Well, these quotes from the president and the vice president, I mean, these are like amazing quotations. A new era of seeing deeper into the universe than ever before has begun. Today represents an exciting new chapter in the exploration of our universe. I mean, those are pretty heavy-duty statements. You know, those are the kind of statements that are grabbers, if you ask me. I mean, wow.
They are. You know, I mean, we hear that a lot, and Kamala Harris, unfortunately, started with the thing that we heard in every documentary about space in the 1940s onward, since the beginning of time when man first looked to the stars. And it's like, you know, you want to go grab her writers and say, don't do that. You know, every dorky science book I read as a kid, the, you know, the big golden book, Golden Book of Galaxies or something started that way. But I got to, you know, I got to hand it to them because really what they're saying in this case is true. I just write it a little differently if they ask me, but obviously they haven't called.
But they didn't. So there you go.
Yeah.
So it's 7:26.
But you did, and that's what counts.
You're absolutely right. So we're going to be breaking for news in about 2.5 minutes. And then on the other side, can you explain what's going to happen after we come back with a guest that you're bringing in?
My dear friend Pascal Lee, who's a planetary scientist with NASA Ames, the SETI Institute, and the Mars Institute, is going to come on to talk about an expedition we'll be doing in August up to a Mars analog base in the Canadian Arctic.
Wait, a Mars analog base in the Canadian Arctic? Boy.
Yes, with polar bears and stuff.
That is intriguing. You will be there too?
I will, for a month.
Wow, a month? Holy cow.
Yeah,
stay on the line.
I like painted discomfort.
Stay on the line there, Rod. That's Rod Pyle.
You got it.
Yeah, we'll be getting back with him and heading towards an analog Mars base in Canada.
Course, Captain? What's the mission?
Our mission? We explore. We seek out new life and new civilizations. We boldly go where no one has gone before.
Cool. Sir.
That does crack me up. Finally, somebody said to the captain, cool, dude. 7:36. John Landecker at 720 WGN. We're talking with Rod Pyle from Ad Astra Magazine. And we're bringing on another guest. And you two guys are going to summer camp. That's what I figured out. I mean, it's summer. You know, people are going to summer camp. Your mom's probably, you know, sewing your name into the back of your underwear so that when you get up to the analog camp of Mars or whatever it is, you guys won't get your clothing mixed up. I'm sorry. I'm just going off on a tangent. So, Rod, introduce our guest and take it away, so to speak. You know what I'm saying?
All right. Our guest is Dr. Pascal Lee, planetary scientist with the NASA Ames Research Center and the SETI Institute and his own organization, the Mars Institute. And about 22 years ago, Pascal took it upon himself to raise money to build a Mars analog base up in the Canadian Arctic and did that and has been running it ever since. And every summer, barring COVID, he goes up and does a number of experiments, usually in association with NASA. How you doing, Pascal?
Hi, John. Hi, Rod. Thank you for
first
dragging
of all,
me into this.
What is a Mars analog base? What does it consist of?
Well, you have to understand where we are up there. We are on Devon Island, which is the largest uninhabited island on Earth. And it's in a corner of the Arctic that is not just cold, but also dry. And so it's not even tundra anymore. Tundra is cold and wet. It's pretty grassy. Here we are in what's called the polar desert of the high Arctic. So it's cold and dry, and it's just a vast, barren expanse. The Devon Island is about the size of West Virginia, with even fewer people in West Virginia. I mean, it's uninhabited.
Wow.
And so when we go up there every summer, we need to set up a camp. And so instead of doing that every year, we've set up a permanent base or semi-permanent base. Mm-hmm. Which we've been occupying every summer since 1997. And the project is funded by NASA. We're conducting experiments for NASA and also sometimes for private industry.
What are the aspects of this base that – is this to emulate something on Mars or
– Well, so the base itself is a regular – polar research station, but it's set in this place that is really so similar to Mars, and of course no place on Earth is really as extreme as Mars, but it's
right.
One giant leap in the right direction. It's cold, it's dry, it's barren, it's rocky, It's unvegetated. It's drenched in ultraviolet light because of the ozone hole of the polar regions in the summer. It has a giant meteorite impact crater that's about 20 kilometers across. I mean, most people are familiar with the meteor crater in Arizona. That thing is just 1.2 kilometers across, or 0.8 miles. Mm-hmm. This thing is 15 miles across, okay, 20 wow. kilometers. And it formed about 23 million years ago, and it has it is so well preserved in this freezer of the Arctic that it looks like it formed yesterday. I mean, if it were smoking, you would think that it formed yesterday, but it's no longer smoking. We roam around this terrain to try to understand why this crater and so many other aspects of the landscape around look like Mars. There are canyons, there are gullies, there are valley networks, all things that are very bizarre, actually, by terrestrial standards, and yet look amazingly similar to what we're seeing on Mars. So we think that the common thread of this story is that this is how the landscape gets shaped in a place that's very cold and dry throughout its history,
uh-huh.
like Mars.
So, Rod, you're going up there for help.
And if I may just add, John, yeah, one thing that he didn't say that is important for people like me who kind of love the thrill ride aspect of this is the mm-hmm. topography is also generally rather reddish. So
no
that
kidding.
That Mars illusion continues. Yeah, so it's cold, it's windy, it's windswept, it's forbidding, and it's kind of red. So for me, that's going to be part of the fun part.
Yeah.
But I know you were joking when you said summer camp, but although I'll be helping with their projects and covering it for the media, you know, there is kind of it's summer camp if you want to endure a little bit more pain than usual. At summer
right.
camp, yeah.
How long is your stay up there, Rod?
3 weeks, right, Pascal?
Wow.
Yeah, this year we have a relatively short campaign, about 3 weeks. Some years we go up there for 8 weeks for the whole summer. This year we haven't been up there in at this point 3 years. We have to skip two summers because of COVID, and so we're finally back. And I'm excited about. I've been living in California for 25 years, and up until the COVID years, I had never spent a summer in California. I was always up on Devon Island.
Yeah, I mean this has like the trappings of a yeah. sci-fi movie where. After a 2 or 3 year period, scientists and astronauts return to a frozen planet that they've not been to
yeah.
for a while. I mean,
we watch videos in the evenings, and we thought we might bring up the thing this time.
Absolutely, because you know I really want to find a frozen lake up there with something oddly ovoid underneath it, and just watch you as we chip through the ice to get the critter out.
Man, oh man! What about daylight? Or I know that how long is a day there now during this time
yeah.
of year?
So in the summer we have permanent daylight, which
yeah.
allows us to take full advantage of good weather when there.
Right, right.
And so we work down the clock in those nights, and then otherwise. The sun starts to dip actually towards the end of August below the horizon. But somewhere from between mid-June to August, the sun never sets.
Yeah.
So unless you know what time it is,
right?
You really can't tell which way is north or south. And
I mean, it's
magnetic
like
compass, incidentally, doesn't work up there because you're so close to the north magnetic pole that the compass would just tell you that you are there.
Oh, man. This is a movie. I'm pole. Telling you, I have seen this movie. I just saw this movie the other night when the compasses didn't work.
And nobody, not everybody dies at the end, though, right, of your movie?
No.
Not everybody.
Okay,
no.
Good.
Okay, this is going to be a very ignorant
question. Just a new guy.
A very ignorant question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because you guys are way above my pay grade. Why is the word analog used to describe this?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I didn't answer that. It's because we draw analogies. We draw,
okay.
we draw comparisons between
gotcha.
The geology of the place with what mm-hmm. we see on Mars, between the biology of this place, because there's still life there. It's mostly in the form of microbes hidden inside rocks,
yeah.
Hiding inside rocks. So we draw analogies with what we might find on Mars as well. We draw analogies in terms of the operations we carry out. Like we go out in small teams. We use ATVs. Sometimes we are donning spacesuits. These are serious spacesuits. They are made by, you know, spacesuit manufacturing companies. So we're testing this or that aspect of actually going back to the moon or going to Mars. And so we're using this place, but we're studying this place, and we're using it as a set in some sense.
So, Rod, you said you're going to cover it for the media. Where can we see your work? Are there videos? Are you going to just write articles or pictures? Or how what can we look forward to? Because I'm looking forward to it already.
Oh, good. Well, my plan is to send some material to my friends over at space.com, which we love. And then for the more involved long articles, I'll be putting them first in Ad Astra magazine and then some other outlets. But Ad Astra, which, as you know, is the publication of the National Space Society. So normally, you know, a couple of years back, you had to be a member to get it. But now it's on newsstands in the U.S. and Canada. So you can find it at Barnes & Noble or Books a Million or wherever.
Oh, I've seen it.
So that will be towards the end of the year.
So what do you expect to get out of this particular stay? Is there something specific that you're aiming for in a relationship between this topography and the environment and the way you believe the surface of Mars is? Is there a specific that you're looking for? Is it just a general?
Yeah, well, so this year we're going to study the canyons in particular because they look amazingly like the ones on Mars, which on Devon Island were formed by glaciers. And so now it's opening up the question as to whether at least some of the canyons on Mars might have been formed by past glaciers there as well. And we'll also be testing spacesuits, and in particular looking at how we can enable a spacesuit to allow an astronaut to fly a drone on Mars one day. As you know, we were talking earlier about the helicopter on Mars, Ingenuity.
Yes.
Well, once humans go to Mars, they will want to use things like helicopters to scout around, to explore, to collect remote samples. That's the type of activity that we're going to start looking into from an operational standpoint this summer. So there's a lot going on, and I'm actually really excited to have Rod come up with us because he's an outstanding space author. He has a real original eye in how he looks at things, and he's very inquisitive. So we're going to have a good time here, introspectively as well.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being with me, and live long and prosper, as they say. And
you dog.
And right. I can't wait to hear about what's going on with you people up there in Canada with your Mars exploration. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. And I can't wait to come back and tell you all about it.
Oh, I can't wait to hear about it.
I'll join us too.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, guys.